Welcome back. You're listening to a news special about the underrepresentation of women in the Kentucky State House. Later in this segment, we'll be talking to State Senator Julie Rocky Adams and State Representative Attica Scott. First, a primer on what we're talking about. Kentucky has one of the worst rates of representation of women in the State House. Only 23 of the 138 seats in the legislature are held by women. That's about 17%. But even across the country, the highest rate of representation is 40% in Arizona and Vermont. So why does this matter? Here's Kelly Dittmar, a political science professor at Rutgers University, Camden.
It matters simply for democratic legitimacy, right? If this is supposed to be a representative democracy, it should actually be representative of the people that it represents.
Kentucky's population is actually made up of slightly more women than men, yet women have never held more than 20% of the seats in the legislature. Dittmar says that keeps some women from seeing themselves as potential lawmakers.
They're not seeing themselves reflected in the bodies of people that are sitting in these legislatures, that are getting covered in the media, that are at these high levels of leadership.
And the imbalance extends to Kentucky's other high-profile elected positions. No women have ever been elected to represent Kentucky in the U.S. Senate. Only two women have represented Kentucky in Congress. And just one woman, Martha Lane Collins, has been governor of Kentucky. According to Secretary of State Allison Lundergan Grimes, 93 women have filed to run for state legislative seats.
We hit a record number of women running for office.
The surge comes amid the Me Too movement and a sexual harassment scandal in the state house. The Louisville Courier-Journal first reported that then-House Speaker Jeff Hoover signed a secret sexual harassment settlement with a staffer who worked for the Republican caucus. Three other Republican lawmakers were implicated in the scandal, and Hoover resigned his leadership position.
I did make mistakes in that I engaged in inappropriate text messages. I engaged in banter that was consensual, but yet no mistake, it was wrong on my part to do that. And for that, I am truly sorry.
Hoover denied sexually harassing the woman, and once the legislature went back into session, he delivered a speech from the House floor, lashing out at another female staffer who blew the whistle on what she called a hostile work environment.
And Mr. Speaker, if that staff person wants to stand in here and smirk as she is right now, that's fine with me. She's your employee, sir.
Hoover is running for re-election unopposed. A state ethics agency will have a hearing to determine if he and the other lawmakers involved should be expelled or fined next month. Jennifer Moore is the founder of Emerge Kentucky, which encourages and trains women to run for office as Democrats in the state. She says the scarcity of women in the legislature has created a culture that allows sexual harassment to thrive.
When you don't have any women legislators in leadership now, whether Democrat or Republican, there's not a single woman in leadership in the House or the Senate. That sends a message.
Only one woman has held a leadership position in the State House, Paris Democratic Representative Sandy Overly, who stepped down from her position this year and isn't running for re-election. Now, turning to our guests in the studio, we have Senator Julie Rocky Adams, a Republican who represents a district that includes the northeast portion of Jefferson County. She's been in office since 2015. Before that, she served on the other side of the Capitol in the State House of Representatives and also was a Louisville Metro Councilwoman. She also runs an organization called Kentucky Strong, which recruits and trains women to run for office as Republicans. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by State Representative Attica Scott, a Democrat who represents House District 41 in Louisville. It's a sliver that extends from Louisville's west side through downtown and to the east side. In 2016, she became the first African-American woman elected to the state legislature in 20 years. She also served on Louisville's Metro Council. Thanks so much for coming in, Representative Scott.
Thanks for having me.
First off, I'd like to ask what you think are the effects, if any, of there being so few women in the legislature?
Well, can we start with what recently happened with Senator Rocky Adams's bill, where you have men who don't understand the importance of certain legislation, and so it doesn't get prioritized? And
so, to clarify, this is a bill that's being considered right now that would change the state's child marriage laws. Currently, there's no lower limit to what age a woman can be married in Kentucky. If she's pregnant, she can get married. Mm-hmm. Anyway, explain a little further, Senator Rocky Adams.
Well, sure. I mean, here it is that there everybody when they start in the legislature, they introduce bills that are of interest to them, that they're passionate about, and they want to spend time on. Those issues for me this session have primarily been women's issues. I've done a child marriage bill, as Representative Scott mentioned. I've done a bill relative to women who are in prison, because that is our fastest growing population. Our women in prison is growing by 17%. And it's frustrating because I'm so passionate about those, but the majority of men in my caucus don't understand those issues. They don't listen to the women who are being affected by those issues. It's more natural for women to come to other women and explain what these public policy deficiencies are. And since there's so few of us, and there's so few of us in the legislature, it's really hard to get these things to bubble up and to be a priority to other people.
Mm-hmm. Representative Scott, you have a bill that would exempt taxation on certain feminine hygiene products and diapers and other items. Do you feel this in the House side, that these issues don't get considered by the body, because it's being led by men, and there's such a high preponderance of men in the legislature?
Definitely. It's an issue that I don't anticipate men to be sensitive towards, because it impacts girls and women for the most part when we're talking about feminine hygiene products. But if they would be willing to broaden their perspective, they would see that these baby products impact the children that they have raised, or the grandchildren that they are raising or care about or love or have affection towards. So what we need is not only more women, but the men who are in office to have more open minds and to understand how they need to be more understanding of issues that impact girls and women in the Commonwealth.
Do you think that there are more hurdles for women trying to get into politics in Kentucky and across the country than there are for men?
I mean, for one, I do think that there are some hurdles. I think that the first is just being the stereotype or the misconception that politics is a high conflict arena in which to involve yourself. The truth is, there are so many professions out there that are high conflict that women thrive in. And so I like to say to people, don't shy away from this because it's high conflict. You can be extremely compelling and extremely successful in this arena. Just give it a shot, because you've got value and you've got a voice and you've got ideas, and I think you could be really successful.
And I would say another one of the obstacles is when you're talking about even your own political apparatus being dominated by men who aren't necessarily thinking about women to run for office, or thinking about women and encouraging women to be in leadership positions, or willing to vote for women to be in leadership positions. That's an obstacle, because then other women don't get to see us in leadership, don't get to see us serving in local and state and federal office.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did you deal with that when you were deciding to run for office? And did you feel that? Did you feel that when you were deciding to run?
I always thought that I was kind of an anomaly. I was like, maybe I have too much testosterone. I don't know. But the very first time I decided to run for office, it was just because I decided to run. And I didn't ask anybody. I didn't find out anybody's opinion. But I'm a rarity. And I just thought, I want to do this. I'm really passionate about some of these neighborhood issues, and so I'm going to run. But I'll tell you, some of my friends said to me, what are you doing? Why would you want to do that? Do you really think you can win? Like, how do you even sign up? Like, there was just so much not ignorance on the part, but nobody really thought that would be a thing to do. But I think that for most women, they need to be cultivated, they need to be asked, they need to be kind of primed for that. And the truth is, once women start to think about that, they go, you know what, I can do this. I would be really good at this. It just takes a little bit of nurturing, a little bit of cultivation. And then I think we can find ourselves really expanding our numbers in Kentucky and getting some really dynamic women involved.
And I'm very similar to Senator Rocky Adams in that I definitely don't seek permission, because I know I won't get it. I'm not right. The kind of candidate, right, that would be supported for the most part by the apparatus that I'm a part of. And so when I first ran for office 8 years ago, it was a roundtable of women of color who said to me, so you're the person we want to run for office and that we're going to support to run for office. Even in this seat, it was a woman who is a current state representative who said to me, so yeah, we need you to run for this seat. So it's always been women who have encouraged me to run. And those are the voices that I listen to, because they're also the ones who do the fundraising, the knocking on doors, the making the phone calls. They do the work to make sure that they get me and other women in office.
We've seen a record number of women filing to run for the state legislature this time around, 93 women. And a lot of the talk is that, you know, some of these women decided to run, you know, especially in reaction to the Me Too movement. Do you attribute that? Do you see that relationship? You know, there just kind of being a new conversation around sexual harassment in our country and in our state. You know, has that pushed more women to run for office, in your opinion?
Well, in Kentucky, I would say that it's a little bit different. It's some of that, but it's also some of the issues that we've been addressing in the past couple of years in the legislature that have encouraged more women, especially educators, to run for office. Educators who don't necessarily see themselves and their issues reflected in Frankfort, and who have felt like, you know, some of the votes and decisions that we've made have been contrary to what they as educators believe in. And so that's why many of the women who are educators have run for office. And I will also say that for some of us, especially people like me who are women of color, we have wanted to run for office for years, but not felt like we would have the support that we needed. So, you know, there are the Rocky Adams and the Scotts who will step out there and run anyway. But then there are the women who really do feel like, I have to have that endorsement and that support before I'm willing to step out there, for a number of reasons, whether it's because of family, whether it's because of work, whether it's because of not necessarily having the finances to be able to make that investment. So I would say that for a while, there have been women who have wanted to run for office, but have not felt like they could do it. And now I believe we're at the point where there are more women who are like us who are saying, you know what? Forget it. I don't have to have your endorsement. I'm going to run anyway.
No, I totally agree with Representative Scott. It's and I think we see it not just in politics. I think that we're seeing it in corporate America. I think we're seeing it in the entertainment industry. It is so past time for us to be paid the same, to be treated the same, to be have the same opportunities. And quite honestly, I really believe that we have had enough. And so you're going to see across the entire spectrum a paradigm shift. And that's a really good thing. You know, one of the questions I get asked almost all the time is, why aren't there more women in Frankfort? And, you know, and that's a really complex question, because like Representative Scott and I, we can go home every night. And so we can see our kids, we can take care of our homes. But if you're not close to Frankfort and you have to drive, you know, 4 hours from Western Kentucky or 3 hours from Eastern Kentucky, that's a real consideration as to is this job the right job for you at this point in your life? If you have aging parents or young kids or, you know, what have you. And so even though I'd like to see more women, there are kind of artificial barriers for some of them to even kind of compete in the arena for these jobs in Frankfort.
You're listening to a Kentucky Public Radio news special. Give us a call at 502-814-TALK to get on the show, or tweet us a question at WFPL News. Continue on the topic of the Me Too movement in Frankfort. This last year and in years prior, we've seen a couple instances of sexual harassment, most recently leading to the resignation of House Speaker Jeff Hoover, as we heard in the intro to this show. In 2013, there was also a Democratic representative, John Arnold from Sturgis, who stepped down after sexual harassment allegations were levied against him. And this just brings the question, does the the low ratio of women in Frankfort in politics, you know, is this something that creates a boys club in these kinds of atmospheres where sexual harassment can really thrive in these situations?
And I don't know if it creates it, or that the boys club already existed, right? That good old boys club already existed, and we as women are stepping into it, and we are working hard every single day to change it. And we know that we can't do it alone, right? Because we're not up there alone. So it's going to take men to step up as well and say that we're going to reject that good old boy environment that has been created, and we're going to create something new and different, a safe place for all of us, and especially for women and girls who are coming up there as grassroots lobbyists or coming up there with their schools to visit. We want this to be a safe place and welcoming place for them as well. And so, I think about the fact that last year we had the state representative from Bullitt County who committed suicide. I remember being on the elevator once with him with my daughter, and I vowed never again to allow myself to be in that situation because it was so uncomfortable. And I remember my daughter just kind of standing there frozen, not knowing what to do. And as women, we often have to think about how do we keep ourselves safe? And our safety is first and foremost. And part of that is our network of support we provide to one another and checking in with one another. But also for me, creating that network of men who I'm able to talk to and say, look, I'm just going to tell you, there's some times I don't feel comfortable, and I need to know that you support me and that you have my back.
And, I agree. I think that, I've been in Frankfort for, 2, 4, 6, 7 years now. I'm going on 8 years. And there is a significant difference in kind of a cultural shift since when I first started 8 years ago to now. It's not perfect, and it's a little bit better, but it could be a lot better. As Representative Scott said, I've had to tell people before, you can't touch me. You are not allowed to touch me. And they look at me as if I have four heads. And I said, no, I don't touch you, so you can't touch me. And you think, I can't believe I'm having these conversations, but you do. And we're better for it. And I do think that the environment is a lot different. And it's people like Representative Scott and myself who really need to continue laying the groundwork and laying those parameters as to what is appropriate behavior in a professional workplace toward women, period.
And we're doing the work to create the environment for all of those women who are going to be coming after us, right?
Correct.
Serving with us. So, we know that we have over, 40 women who have filed to run for office, actually more than 100, but I think so, nearly 40 of them around the Commonwealth in local and state offices are Emerge Kentucky women. And so we're creating this safe space for them so that when they get here in 2020 or 2018, wait. 2019, next year.
2019,
yeah,
yep.
Next year, that
it's like
it will
her
be,
life is flashing before our eyes.
It is. It's moving quickly. That they are in a different position than when we got here.
I want to peel back the curtain a little bit on some of the discussions of leadership in and when leadership elections take place. And Representative Scott, you've seen this one time around, and I guess a little in 1.5 times around in the House. Does this come up? Does this topic come up of why isn't there a woman in leading one of these chambers?
Well, it comes up at least on my side because I have let it be known that I am interested in pursuing a leadership position. I do feel as if I have been given a huge leadership responsibility as chair of the Senate Health and Welfare Committee, which is a significant committee. We do a lot of, we have a lot of business that comes before. And so I've been very honored to be what I consider part of leadership as a committee chair. But I think it's still super important that we have that woman in the actual leadership of the Senate and the House. I'll never forget when Sani Overly first got elected to leadership, and I went as soon as I found out. I went to my office and I wrote her a note, and everyone's like, "What are you doing?" And I'm like, "I'm writing Representative Overly a note." I said, "This is huge. I'm really proud of her." And they're like, "She's in the other party." And I said, "Absolutely, but I'm really proud of her. Good for her, and good for women that she is now in leadership. It's great."
All right, we're coming up to a break, and we're going to have to say goodbye to our lawmakers. Thanks to Representative Attica Scott and State Senator Julie Rocky Adams for coming in and talking with us.
Thanks for having us.
You're listening to a Kentucky Public Radio news special. Call us at 502-814-TALK or tweet us at WFPL News to get your comments in.
You're listening to 89.3 WFPL Louisville. Good evening, I'm Jill Fox. Thanks for listening today. Support comes from listeners and from BC Plumbing, specializing in the renovation and restoration of older homes, working with homeowners from design to completion on kitchen and bathroom remodels and additions. Information available at bcplumbing.net. And from Louisville Classical Academy, K through 12 in the Highlands, accepting applications and hosting Greek Mythology Day, where students can create mythical beasts, design armor, and revel in the stories of gods and heroes, Sunday, March 18th at 2, registration for this ticketless event at louisvilleclassicalacademy.org. Stay tuned for more on 89.3 WFPL. We're online at wfpl.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to a Kentucky Public Radio news special about women in politics in the state. We're broadcasting live on our stations across Kentucky, WFPL Louisville, WEKU Richmond, WKU Public Radio in Bowling Green, and WKMS Murray. Give us a call at 502-814-TALK to get on the show or tweet us a question at WFPL News. I'm joined in the studio by Tina Ward Pugh, who used to serve on Louisville Metro Council and before that was a member of Louisville's Council of Aldermen before the city merger. She now works for Louisville's Office for Women. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
And on the phone, we have University of Kentucky historian Randolph Hollingsworth. She specializes in women's history and Southern history and is currently working on the Kentucky Woman Suffrage Project. Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Councilwoman Ward Pugh, I'd like to start off with you. Over the course of your time in office, did you see the tides turning on this issue at all?
You know, I did. First of all, let me say thank you for having me. It's good to be back here. It has changed, and I'm grateful for that, although it certainly hasn't improved to the degree that any of us would like. But I, as a reminder, any kind of lasting change does take time in hopes that there's not a backlash. But, I mean, just when I started out and was elected in 1998 and started my first term, I was a budding young feminist and insisted that my colleagues call me Alderwoman. Well, some of my female colleagues said, well, she must not be comfortable with her sexuality. And I'm thinking that has nothing to do with that. And eventually they called me that. And then we transitioned to the merged government. And it was a no-brainer that we would be councilmen and councilwomen or just council members. I worked hard to change the language in the ordinances to be gender neutral or to always be inclusive, he, she, and it caught on. And so now a number of council members have that, you know, in their repertoire or are attuned to it. But, you know, we are losing, you know, we only had at that time 6 out of the 15 Democrats were women. And only 2 of the 11, including Senator Rocky Adams, who was just on. And when they left, she and Councilwoman Call, it was just a terrible exit for someone who was active and bipartisan. But it has changed. It's been gradual, but we certainly aren't there yet.
Can you talk a little bit more about that language? You know, why is that so important? And do you think that it helps, that it changes minds?
Oh, absolutely. Language is everything because it's how we communicate with one another. It's what informs our dialogue and our positions on things. And so, for instance, when I was came here to go to graduate school back in the late 80s and, you know, woke up, I tell people I woke up. And some of that was realizing the disenfranchisement of women in all areas and walks of life. And so, you know, as I began to understand about language that you can't say, you know, he this and he that, and then just say, well, you know, I mean everybody. It doesn't really work well when I decide to say to my daddy and others, you know, I'm going to just use she all the time, but you need to understand I mean everybody. Well, after about 3 times in a sentence referring to him as she and everybody as she, you know, you would think the world was coming to an end. And so the point is language reflects our thinking and our evolution.
Professor Hollingsworth, can you talk a little bit about how we got here? I know this is kind of a big question. I know you're working on an anthology of Kentucky women from prehistory to contemporary times. You know, why do we still not have parity in elected office? How did we get here?
It is a big question. And I agree totally with Councilwoman Ward Pugh's assertion that language matters. What happens is that people stop asking questions if we don't use language that's accurate, and that's what I'm hoping that we raise up as an awareness, that we need to ask a lot more questions like, yeah, how did we get here? Well, I do want to say that women have always been here.
Sure.
and so really, in less structured times, when Europeans came into this area of the nation, women were part of decision making in a lot of cases. And once the constitutions were created, the first Kentucky Constitution, then the word male was inserted and enforced. So it's not like women just weren't there, and now in the 21st century we're here. It's that there were very specific constructs that disenfranchised women. And what's kind of fun about Kentucky history, now I'm going to get on my soapbox here, is that Kentucky was actually the first state in the new nation in 1838 to pass a law that says that women should vote in school board elections. So when we established our new common school system here in Kentucky, in that great era of social reform, they saw women as an important part, and specifically wrote into the Constitution that women would be able to vote outside of the cities, because the cities already had a lot of had their school board elections already expressed. But in the rural areas in Kentucky, women were voting formally in school boards.
Again, from that broad historical perspective, can you say that, do you feel like some of those barriers have in general been falling down over the course of history? Has the, I guess the fabled arc of justice always been bending, or moral arc been bending towards justice?
Right. No. It's really a strange up and down thing. Some people might see it as a pendulum swing. With the Civil War and the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, these are federal changes to our Constitution that began to define what in a post-Civil War environment, what it means to be a citizen. And women's groups were an intimate part of that discussion, and they felt that they lost out when the 14th Amendment specified for voting purposes only males were protected in their suffrage rights. So that's where a lot of the big organizational efforts began. In fact, women were, as today, on different sides of the political spectrum and had different clubs and organizations that they supported, and sometimes worked against each other. But ultimately, we do have a suffrage movement that leads to the 19th Amendment. And even then, we had a Kentuckian, Laura Clay, who said, no, we don't want any more federal amendments. We got to do this state by state, because that's where the system is located to define who gets to vote and who doesn't. So it's kind of fun. We had in and out, and in the 1890s, we had a special case in Kentucky history where women, black and white, were able to vote in school board elections. And in fact, the role of black women clubs and was such that they were very organized in their process of registering and then voting. And in the 1890s, we see a strong output of women voters on selected issues, and so much so that in 1901, the fellows go back into the legislature and revoke school suffrage because, well, the women were very organized, and in particular African-American women, and right at the height of Jim Crow, we have not only black women's activism scaring a lot of the politicians of the day, but it was also had to do with the fact that African-American women were voting on the Republican ticket. Yeah. So
we have a question on Twitter here. Does a woman have to be, quote, likable to be elected to office in Kentucky? And if so, how does she remain true to herself? Smile more? I think that, you know, to boil down the question a little bit, are these kind of added barriers that women have to, you know, juggle with to, both, say, appear more stereotypically like a politician in some ways and maintain have stereotypical masculine properties and also maintaining some sense of, acceptable femininity at the same time? Is this a challenge that women candidates and politicians have to deal with?
Well, I can speak for that just from my own experience. Certainly there was a time during my tenure just as an activist, political activist, helping elect a lot of the women judges that ended up being the majority on the court here in Jefferson County for that. And certainly, what I like to say is that we are ever in transition here. The millennials and the younger folks want us to hurry up and get there because they get it. The rest of us who are 50 and older are desperately trying to make that transition, to be able to reflect those values and those changes in language and norms and expectations. But it's harder for some than others. And so, of course, maybe not as much now, perhaps, but if you're in a legislature that's dominated by men who weren't reared to be the boys and young men of today who are caring, who accept people for who they are and what they have to offer and want to work beside them regardless of their gender or anything else. When you're in a legislature like Kentucky, Senator Adams said, I have to tell my colleagues, my male colleagues, you can't do that. You can't touch me. And so, we're perhaps a little behind we're a little slower than the rest, than some parts of the country in doing that. But for the most part, I think people on a local level, especially, can treat you with dignity and respect and not just be put off when you're a woman legislator and you come in and you're not dressed exactly like you're expected to. Or, I know when Councilwoman Scott was on the Metro Council, there were some people who objected when she came and had her hair braided, and talk about being floored by that. Most everybody just couldn't imagine that anybody would say that or think that she couldn't reflect who she is and how she wanted to wear her hair. So it definitely still exists, but it has been changing.
Yeah. And Professor Hollingsworth, can you talk about that effect over history? Over the course of the last century, as women broke down barriers in Kentucky, Governor Martha Lane Collins, Kentucky's first congresswoman, going back, what kind of challenges did these women face breaking into this world that's was then totally dominated by men?
Well, I think Governor Collins today is very beautiful, and she certainly was beautiful when she was running for office, and I think that cannot be discounted. But then you go a little bit further back, and there's that awesome Thelma Stovall, mm-hmm. Probably one of the most exciting politicians, and I wouldn't say that she would win any beauty contest, but by golly, she knew how to work the system. I think it has a lot to do with knowing how to interact as a minority in a majority situation. May Street kid and Georgia Davis Powers probably are really good examples of women who got things done when people didn't expect them to. But, you know, going further back, like people like Emma Guy Cromwell in the 1920s, she was the first woman elected as Kentucky's Secretary of State, and actually went on to serve as acting governor of Kentucky in 1923. But she has this beautiful book that she wrote about a decade later that it's called Woman in Politics, and you can kind of just see how anxious she was about how she was perceived and how she had to really think clearly and carefully about how to approach someone, you know, when you had to get things done.
Another question from Twitter. Fierce panel, what's the single best preparation for a young woman who wants to be a politician? Councilwoman.
Wow. To be able to answer the question when I walk up to you out of nowhere and say, why are you running for office? You need mm-hmm. to give your three sentences about why you're running for office. You shouldn't do it because we need more women to run. You should do it because you believe you have something to offer to that. And I would argue everybody that's running has so much to offer, and we need more and more. You know, you need to read. You need to understand the history. You need to reach out to people who are already in elective office, regardless of what party you're in. You know, there are women out there who've forged ahead.
We've got another break coming up. Thanks very much to our guests for tuning in. You're listening to Kentucky Public Radio Network.
You're listening to 89.3 WFPL Louisville. Good evening. I'm Jill Fox. Support today comes from listener members and from Brown-Forman's Old Forester Bourbon, supporting Eve Theater Company's original production, Sisters in Song, a celebration of some of Kentucky's most famous singers, premiering at the Bardstown Theater March 8th through 11th, part of Women's History Month. Tickets at thebardstowntheater.org. From Spalding University's Auerbach School of Occupational Therapy, offering an information session for students seeking to earn their MSOT, Tuesday, March 27th from 4 to 5 p.m. at COSER Charities College of Health and Natural Sciences, 901 South 3rd Street. Registration at spalding.edu/degree/Master of Science in Occupational Therapy. Stay tuned for more on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back. You're listening to a Kentucky Public Radio news special about women in Kentucky politics. Thanks to our previous guests, the former Louisville Metro Councilwoman Tina Ward Pugh and University of Kentucky History Professor Randolph Hollingsworth. On the line now, we have Jody Thomas, is Executive Director for the National Foundation for Women Legislators. She was the Finance Director for two presidential campaigns and worked in President George W. Bush's administration. Hello.
Hello, Ryland. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for coming on. Also on the phone, we also have Debbie Walsh, director of the Center for American Women and Politics, which researches and promotes the participation of women in politics. Hello, Debbie.
Hello. Thanks for having me. And hello, Jody. It's been a while.
Hi, Debbie. How are you?
Jody, let's start off with you. For a bit of context, can you give us a lay of the land? How does Kentucky compare to the rest of the country when it comes to the number of women in elected office?
You know, Debbie's the one who's got those statistics better than I do.
All right.
Deb, do you know those off the top of your head?
Sure. Well, Kentucky is not doing very well when it comes to women elected to the state legislature. Kentucky currently ranks 42nd in the nation for the percentage of women serving in its state legislature with 16.7%, which means Kentucky is in the bottom 10 for women's representation at that level. You currently have no women in your congressional delegation, but two women who are serving statewide. So doing a little better there, but I don't have statistics about where you are when it comes to local office.
And Jody, you know, just to start things off, and Debbie, please feel free to weigh in. What do you see as being the legislative effect of getting more women elected? Our state lawmakers were talking a little bit earlier about some specific pieces of legislation that they felt we're being ignored by some male leaders in the legislature. You know, are there particular policies, or is it just in general having more women on the, representing districts when it comes to these big pension and budget issues, say here in the state?
Mm-hmm. And Ryland, we feel very strongly that having more women in office is going to do a number of things. Number one, women represent over half of the population, but unfortunately, we only represent about 24% of the state elected officials. When you have more women in office, you have a greater chance at civility. And that's something we are working very hard on now in NFWL. We're working with the National Institute for Civil Discourse. Women are just naturally more willing to negotiate. We're more willing to compromise. We're more willing to work with someone across the aisle. We're more willing on a piece of legislation, for example. Women are more willing to say, okay, I'd rather have 80% of something than 100% of nothing. So I'm going to go ahead. We're going to compromise on this because that gets the majority of what I want, and I'll come back next year and try again for the other 20%. So, you know, Deb, jump in. No, please.
Oh, I was just going to say that I think that your two previous guests, the two state legislators who were on earlier, really talked about it so well, because it's that because what we know from our research is that women bring a different set of life experiences to the making of public policy. And those different life experiences are reflected in their policy priorities. And it's not necessarily that the men are opposed to these things. It's that some of these issues don't even occur to them. So kind of the question that was raised before about feminine hygiene products and taxing those, thinking about that as an issue, it's not that men are opposed to it, but it just doesn't occur to them. And we know from our research also that women, as Jody has just said, women are more likely to work across the aisle. They believe government should operate more transparently. And they do have a kind of sense of responsibility that they need to bring to bear and speak out for people who aren't normally at the table. And it's not just women. It's women, people of color, low-income people, people from urban areas, voices that aren't always represented in our electoral process, and women bring that to the table.
Mm-hmm. How do you see the Me Too movement playing a role in the political scene these days? And, do you see this as being a factor in more women running for office? Is this something that you've seen across the country? It's at least more women are running for office in Kentucky. Do you attribute some of these increases to the Me Too movement?
Yeah, we're seeing record numbers of women running at every level of office, the U.S. House, the U.S. Senate, and also for governor. And I think there are a lot of factors. I think the Me Too movement is one factor. I think the election of Donald Trump has been another factor. This is largely a phenomenon that we're seeing on the Democratic side, more on the progressive side. Many of these women are Democratic women who are running as challengers to incumbent Republicans, and they want to change the face of power. And I think women have really feel very strongly now in ways they might not have before that they need to have a voice in the political process, that their voices are not being heard or not being represented. I think the Me Too movement is all part of that. It's very hard to disentangle one from the other, but I think that it's all been a factor of building momentum that is leading to these records that we're seeing of women stepping up and running for office.
I just want to jump in again, and if anybody has any questions, please give us a call at 502-814-TALK or tweet us at WFPL News. Shifting to kind of a wonky political topic, I've always wondered, how does redistricting, or does redistricting or the way current districts are drawn now play a role in, the current ratio of your gender ratio in state government? Does the fact that kind of the current system encourages or promotes incumbency, keep kind of fresh blood, which very well might include women, from running for office?
I believe it does, Ryland, but not to a great extent. I've been involved in a number of redistricting situations, and I've never seen anyone or an entity really say, "Oh, well, we've got to redistrict out, a woman because she's a woman." I've seen women redistricted out, but it, in my opinion, and Deb, help me here. In my opinion, it's more about party than it is gender in redistricting.
It's very much incumbency protection, and that, as you say, is one of the things that keeps any new faces out. And women, sadly, in 2018, are still considered new faces. But we have looked a little bit at some instances, and there have been some cases in Minnesota and California, in my state here in New Jersey, where we did see women disproportionately impacted in a negative way when it came to redistricting. It seemed as though there are times when the parties are kind of making their deals to make certain seats safer, that women can, in fact, be the sacrifice that a party is willing to make.
Do you think also in the, in these times, do you think that political parties are considering more women for high profile offices? I mean, certainly we saw Hillary Clinton securing the candidacy for the nomination to be the Democratic candidate for president. Is this a trend that is continuing upward?
Well, I certainly think it is.
I think we have to wait and see. I mean, there is real partisan difference, however, and I think that's important to note. Neither party has political parity, but if you look at state legislatures or Congress, women make up a larger proportion of Democratic elected officials than Republican women do on the Republican Party. So, for instance, in Congress right now, women make up almost a third of all the Democratic members of Congress, but on the Republican side, women make up only about 10% of all the Republicans holding office. So the Republican Party, we really need, if we're going to have political parity, we need both parties to do more. But the Republican Party really does need to do more, because there are lots of great Republican women out there who want to run, but they're not able to break into the system, and that's a real problem.
Mm-hmm. And I think, Debbie, I saw an article in the Washington Post about a month ago. And, Virginia has, and so does New Jersey, has off-year elections. And in Virginia's 2017 election, 15 more female legislators were elected to the state house. And that's huge for Virginia.
We have another question from Twitter. Such a great conversation. My question is, how does one get involved in local and state politics? How can we encourage fresh faces to run for office?
You know, and Debbie's the expert on this, there are so many organizations now to help women either get elected to office or even become volunteers to help other women get elected for office. We are so fortunate that we're seeing organizations, some on the left, some on the right, and some are bipartisan. And so I would encourage any woman who's thinking about running to go to one of these conferences. Debbie's organization does a fabulous training program. It's sold out every time. And find out what it really takes, because some of the Virginia women had great encouragement to run from other women, but they didn't get the party support. As Debbie said, a lot of times the women become the sacrificial lamb. And so, women need to kind of do that kind of groundwork. They need to be able to prove that they are good fundraisers. Because that's the first thing the party how much money can you raise?
I think that's absolute. Money, unfortunately, still reigns supreme. I would say that it's also really important to get involved with one of the two political parties. whether you're a Democrat or you're a Republican. There is a program that I would encourage people to go to our website, which is cawp.rutgers.edu, and we have a resource map for women who are interested in getting more involved in politics. You can look on the state of Kentucky and see all the various programs, including the Democratic Women's Club of Kentucky and the Kentucky Federation of Republican Women. But also there is a very good partisan training program in Kentucky, Emerge Kentucky, which is for Democratic women. There isn't anything quite like that on the Republican side, although there should be. And then there are some leadership programs. There's a program called Women Leading Kentucky. I don't know a lot about these programs, but general leadership programs that get you more engaged in the community are also really good ways to get involved. But I think Jody's point about go out and work for some candidates who are running for office that you can support, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, and get yourself involved in politics. Go to meetings. Go to your local council meetings. See who's there. Ask a question when you show up at a meeting so people know who you are. And there are lots of appointed positions as well, not just at the state level, but in every town and municipality, there's local boards that oftentimes there are vacancies and local elected officials are looking for people to serve on them, whether it's a planning board or a zoning board. These are ways to get involved in politics. And I think it's really important to remember politics and government, it's not just every 4 years for the presidential or even every 2 years for congressional races and state legislative races. It's every year there are elections, and just we need more women to be involved at every level.
We talked about this a little bit in the earlier segments. Is there, you know, do they have to navigate extra hurdles that men don't generally have to when running for office? You know, dealing with expectations of, being a stereotypical politician while also having to maintain some stereotypes, some other stereotypes.
You know, Ryland, fortunately, I think we're gradually getting away from that. It's nothing like it was 15, 20, 25 years ago. It's certainly not solved yet. But, yes, I do believe that women have to overcome certain hurdles.
And thanks to Jody Thomas and Debbie Walsh so much for coming on the show. We're running out of town. Debbie Walsh, director of the Center for American Women in Politics, and Jody Thomas is executive director for the National Foundation for Women Legislators. Thanks for coming on. This is the Kentucky Public Radio Network.